This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hey, you're not going to bed yet, are you? That's right. It's time for TV Good, Sleep Bad.
TV is awesome! TV is awesome!
Here are your hosts, Daniel Lackey and Elwood Jones.
Hello and welcome to the first edition of TV Good Sleep Bad, the show which stays at way past its bedtime to indulge in its cool TV loving habits. This is obviously the first show of 2016, a whole brand new year of cool TV goodness. But joining me, as always, is my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Hello.
And joining us in the basement for this first show of the year, we've got a very special guest, as we're joined by Will Slater of Exploding Helicopters.
Thanks for inviting me on.
On tonight's show, we are obviously going to be celebrating the relaunch of sorts of the X-Files, as we're going to be checking out an old episode by looking at the episode Home. We're also going to be looking at one of the shows which was a key inspiration for the X-Files when we look at an episode of Kolchak the Night Stalker with the episode 3, They Have Been, They Are, They Will Be, also known as UFO. But first of all, Will, obviously your site's Exploding Helicopter, and you've also got the podcast Exploding Helicopter, because apparently this love of chopper fireballs can't be contained to just one site. You've decided to branch out and do an audio version as well. Where did the love of Exploding Helicopters start, really, for those that are not familiar with your site?
Yeah, thanks. So, yeah, I'm Will, and I run Exploding Helicopter, which, as you said, is a website and podcast where we celebrate the weird and wonderful world of exploding helicopters. So if you watch a lot of films, you may have started to notice that helicopters do explode an awful lot of the time, and often in some very strange ways. So I wanted to set up a website, and obviously now it's spun off into a podcast, to kind of shine a light on this on basically my favorite movie trope, and the kind of where I fell in love with exploding helicopters. I was watching a very trashy straight to DVD movie called Cyborg Cop, essentially a kind of RoboCop ripoff, and I was watching it with a friend of mine, and they said that this helicopter kind of hove into view, and they said, oh, I bet that helicopter is going to explode. Sure enough, within 5 or 10 seconds it did, and it was kind of like a eureka moment, because I suddenly realized, my goodness, you know, these helicopters, they're just, you know, if you see one in a movie, they're basically destined for the chopper graveyard. And after that kind of planted a seed in my mind, and about 8 years ago now, I decided, right, I'm going to dedicate some of my time to celebrating this particular world.
And how long has the site been running for now?
So I think we launched in 2009, got off to a bit of a slow start, but we've sort of upped our game a little bit then. So yeah, we've been going for about 7 years now.
So 7 years of fiery chopperball explosions, and you're still not tired of it, as we were obviously discussing prior to us coming on the air tonight, and this is an obsession which has been going for 7 years, and you're still finding ever more unique ways, I'm guessing, for choppers to explode.
Well, that's right. I mean, we're still finding people who are, well, filmmakers are still finding new ways to explode helicopters. So as long as they keep doing that, I think my love for exploding helicopters is going to remain. So I kind of did think that this was a project I was going to get on top of at some stage, that I would sort of have done, you know, I'd have broken the back of the number of films that have exploding helicopters in. But as I've got deeper and deeper into it, I've realized that this is a task far bigger than I could ever possibly have imagined.
Yeah, I can certainly imagine so, especially when you look at the sort of key trashy era of, well, 80s VHS, really. There's probably a fair amount of material just in there alone. But, Lucky, do you have any favorite exploding choppers?
It was actually rather hilarious, and I think, if I recall correctly, I put this on Twitter at the time, and you answered it, Will, where I had, I was at Fantastic Fest last year, and for those who have never been to Fantastic Fest, before they run the movies, they have these programs before the movies where they'll run, like, clips from, like, foreign television shows, foreign language TV shows or movies or exploitation films or B-movies or, like, bizarre music videos or what have you. And at one point, there was a clip, and I didn't really catch the context of what was going on, but it featured what appeared to be a high school American football team doing some sort of thing, and then there is a scene where one of them throws a football at a helicopter, and it explodes when it makes contact. And I seem to remember you mentioning something like that on a podcast we'd been on together earlier, so I remember Twittering it, and you said it was one of two. And it was this one from the – it was the older one from the 70s.
Well, I think the film that you're – I think the film that you must have seen is a film from 1990, a kind of Italian action exploitation flick called The Last Match, which its preposterous plot involves a kind of the kidnapping of an American teenager in some sort of invented Caribbean island. And the authorities won't take any action, so the distraught father enlists the help of an American football team who happen to be on the island as well. And they basically rescue this girl by launching a full-out assault on the baddies using their American football skills, obviously all dressed up in their American football uniforms. And as you say, they get hold of a grenade. One of the players gets hold of a grenade, stuffs it inside an American football, and punts it into this helicopter that is flying overhead. The football sort of meets the helicopter or goes inside. It's a little unclear, and explodes. And that's the famous exploding helicopter from The Last Match. There is another American football related helicopter explosion in 1999's Three Kings, where I can't remember who the actor is in it, but again, he ties some sticks of dynamite or some explosive to the side of American football and throws it quarterback style at the helicopter and destroys it that way. So yeah, American footballs combined with explosives have actually downed a surprising number of helicopters in movies.
I'd have to say that it was The Last Match, because I know it wasn't Three Kings, because I had seen Three Kings not too long before that. And also, Three Kings is an actually fairly respectable movie, comparatively. And which is just not the sort of, I mean, we're talking about, the curation for these little clips that would run before the movies, I mean, Boney M. music videos would run, you know?
Nice.
You know, and it was like, I had known their song Rasputin entirely by reputation, but that was like the first time I'd ever actually heard it, and I was completely gobsmacked. It was as absolutely mind-bendingly brilliant as I had always imagined it would be. But yeah, that was a particular moment, and even now, you know, whenever I see, like, in a TV show, like, a helicopter explode, I saw one in an old Doctor, I think it was story, I think it was The Enemy of the World, exploding helicopter. Oh, I better tell Will about this.
Well, I'm restricting myself to films only, not TV, because I've got my work cut out with movies. I can't, at this stage, think to expand the project to take in TV as well.
Yeah.
I have to say, when you obviously mentioned about Boney M. playing before films at the, I think it was Fantastic Fest, was it you were saying?
Yeah, yeah.
There's been this whole spate of festivals I've seen popping up where it's free to get in, but you have to pay to get out. And it's like this endurance test that they just bombard you with, like, awful TV shows and awful movies. And, like, for every hour that goes past, they knock, like, $5 off the release fee.
Oh my god, it sounds like heaven.
But yeah, that's quite a good concept. I like that.
So, and I know that there was someone, I can't remember who it was now, but I know, I think it was over on Podcast Town, they were saying, like, down in Australia, they hold, like, a Christmas film festival, and it's just, like, all these, like, tacky and awful alternate sort of Christmas TV and, like, film moments and stuff. So they show, like, Santa Claus Conquers the Martians and, like, some American football team singing Christmas carols and parts of the Pee Wee Herman Christmas special and stuff, so... But I think that'd be really awesome if we had those sorts of things over here in the UK, especially because we don't tend to do the alternate sort of film festivals. We used to have them in, like, the mid-90s, back at sort of the height of video trading, should we say. I don't want to say video piracy, because that was something completely different. But certainly the video trading, we have the, like, all-night film festivals, and you see things like Slugs and Necronomicon and like, these movies that wouldn't get any sort of airtime, especially over here in the UK where we only had like four TV channels.
Yeah.
And especially not on the BBC. But, you know, that's always an argument for another day.
The thing you do have to realize is that you do live in a comparatively sane country where it wouldn't necessarily, you know, occur to people to do stuff like that. Whereas in Australia, they live on an island, a continent that is literally trying to kill them at every moment. You know, so it's like Australia is probably like the deadliest place to live in the world. That place is not fit for, I mean, biologically, you know, I'm sure, I mean, their culture is wonderful, their music wonderful, it's all that, but there's so many insects and animals and reptiles on that planet that are, island there, it's trying to kill you at every moment, so.
It makes me surprised there's not been more Animals Gonna Mock movie come out of Australia, because you only had, what, you had Dark Age, you had Rogue, and you had Razorback. I think those are the three that really came out. I think all the others have all been American-based, so...
I mean, yeah, I mean, that Australia would be the perfect country to, like, you know, spawn a movie like Carnosaur, you know?
But, Will, if you were going to obviously program as a film festival of exploding helicopter goodness, if you would like to pick three or four films, what would be, like, your golden selection that you would want to show us?
Oh, goodness. I would definitely have to have Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, in there. It is a balmy film from start to finish, but it does have a spectacularly weird chopper fireball in there, where one is brought down by Sheena, who is this sort of... think of her as a kind of Tarzan-like figure, but with a sort of... Doctor sort of Doolittle ability to psychically communicate with animals, and she uses her psychic powers to bring down this helicopter using a flock of flamingos. I forget the correct collective noun for flamingos. So I definitely have to have that in there. I think probably it's a pretty awful film, but Battleship would probably need to be in there because it does have the most exploding helicopters of any film. There are 8 are exploded in one orgy of chopper fireball goodness in there. And another film that I would pick, I'd probably also pick The Swarm as well, because that is we get to see two helicopters brought down there by a swarm of bees who are flying at the frightening prospects flying at the frightening speed of 7 miles per hour. It really is, though the pilots of those helicopters would deserve to win a Darwin Award for stupidity. So I think that would make I think those three films would make a nice good exploding helicopter program of films.
Cool. I was the only one I'm surprised that you didn't include would be Broken Arrow, just for the sheer amount of helicopters blown up in it. I would have thought that would have been like real top of the list for you, but definitely some great selections though, and certainly with Sheena, which we can actually cover on the show, Lackey. We should be excited about this because we can look at the 2000 version, which starred Baywatch's Gina Lee Nolan.
Yay!
And ran for 35 episodes, and where she could turn herself into any animal she gazed upon.
Yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to watch Gina Lee Nolan.
So, it's all the looking up.
The enthusiasm was overwhelming.
Yeah.
Is already looking up this year.
Yeah, it's going to be a cracker. Yeah, this is going to be a crackerjack of a year. I can already tell.
But then again, I'm after our Christmas special. I'm surprised we're still on the air. But because, you know, sponsors. We don't need no stinking sponsors on this show, that's for sure. But saying that, we do want to give a big thank you to our sponsors of sorts and partners, Channel Super Hero, your one-stop shop for all your TV Super Hero goodness. You can find it at channelsuperhero.com. On there, we've got not only the current TV proper TV superheroes, such as The Flash, Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow. We're also looking at classic TV superheroes as well, with classic Batman, Buffy recaps, and Walking Dead as well on there. So there's a whole heap of stuff on there for anyone who likes their TV superheroes. So certainly recommend checking them out, channelsuperhero.com. Also, I forgot to say thank you as well at the start to our good friend The Vern, who put together our new intro theme. So thank you very much to The Vern. You probably recognized his vocals there, but you can also check out his site at The Vern's Video Vortex, as well as his podcast, the As You Watch podcast as well. Thank you again to The Vern. But what have we all been watching recently? Obviously, we just had Christmas. We're now into essentially the new season of TV, with a lot of shows coming out, such as Legends of Tomorrow has just recently started over in the States. We've got The X-Files starting on Sunday.
Yep.
As of this episode, we're recording here on the 22nd. It's due to go out on Sunday in the States. In the UK, we are still waiting to get a date because Channel 5 decided to outbid Sky 1 for the rights and then, you know, think, well, it's okay, we'll just show it a couple of weeks after the States. People are not going to pirate it at all.
Nobody's going to go and smear spoilers all over Facebook.
Yes, of course, because the American audiences aren't just going to crap all over it for the British fans, are they? So, yeah, great move there, Channel 5.
Yeah.
What is very exciting, though, with obviously the release of the new series, we've got a whole line of new figurines coming out. In particular, Titan are releasing the Truth Is Out There collection. It's due to come out on the 28th, so just after the TV series being released. This is actually delayed as it was supposed to come out around Christmas, and it's a 12-figure set. They are blind bagged, so I can see a lot of duplicates here, although you can buy the complete collection if you're willing to fork out a bit of extra cash there. As well as all the usual figures, we've got some really interesting selections as well, as the set's also going to include Tombs, the Fluke Man, the Great Mutato, Lanny from Humbug, as well as Mrs. Peacock, Mrs. Paddock from Die Hand Die Verletzt. Thank you. I'm struggling to pronounce that one. She obviously was the witch/science teacher lady.
Yep.
I apologize to any X-Files fans out there that I'm butchering the details of this. The last three in particular I'm very intrigued about because these aren't sort of mainstream choices you'd expect to see someone like Krycek above, like the Great Mutato. So it's really interesting to see them branching out and not just recycling the same popular characters again. So it's nice to obviously have something extra for the X-Files fans. So obviously, since the show ended, they've gone and had a bit of a drought with the collectibles. So it's been a bit of a job trying to find collectibles because obviously Forbidden Planet and that haven't been stocked them, but we'll hopefully see some more stuff coming in now.
I'm really hoping they maybe, you know, do figures for, like, you know, Bambi, Barenbaum from War of the Copperphages, and for I think it's Queequeg was the name of the dog.
Yes.
Clyde Bruckman's dog that Scully adopted.
The dog has frequently come up, even though X-Files fans have frequently, like, created fan fiction where the dog dies horribly.
Yeah.
Apparently nobody likes the dog.
Oh, I think the dog is great.
I mean, I would really love to see Krycek get a figure just because he's the most awesome thing in the X-Files.
With or without the missing arm or no missing arm.
That's, I don't know. Maybe they could do like a figure where you alter and you can like take the hand off and like swap it around.
There you go.
I mean,
when I was a kid, I had a C-3PO action figure from The Empire Strikes Back, you know, you could like disassemble and put in a little bag and stick on your Chewbacca's figured back. And maybe that's what they should do with the Krycek one.
Yeah, I would say that they would have a plastic hand, but then again, he already has a plastic hand in this figure, so... I mean, I would also like to see Lanny's twin. I'm not sure, because I've obviously been him a lot smaller than Lanny, how it would work as a figure. I'd also like to see the Peacock Brothers from Home. So you could have a full set. You could obviously have... you could have, like, Mrs. Peacock and have them, like, on a board or something.
Yeah.
And I'd also love to see the doll from Chinga, the episode written by Stephen King.
Yeah. I'd like to see a Suzanne Modesky.
Okay.
From Unusual Suspects, I'd like to see her. I think I don't remember his name, but the killer from Pusher and Kitsunagari. I'd like to see one of him.
And I think the only other one I would like to see, I'd like to see Cyril from Fire.
Yeah.
But then again, I want him to obviously come with a little soundbox just so he can say, "I'm the gardener now."
Yeah, that would be.
But, Will, do you have any figures you'd like to see at the X-Files? I don't know if you want any X-Files collectibles at all.
I really am not in the market for X-Files collectibles, I don't think. My appreciation of the show doesn't run that far.
That's fair enough. Did you have any sort of relationship with the show when originally, and are you excited to obviously see it back for this little mini-series?
I watched the X-Files was huge when it was on TV, and sort of like everybody else, I watched it and really, really enjoyed it. But it's not a series that I kind of formed a huge sort of attachment to that has ever sort of meant that I've bothered to catch reruns of it. So, it was a good show, but not one that's really sort of hung with me.
Yeah, it was very much a cultural thing when it came out. And I think it's really a sign of the changing times that you would have shows come out back when this show was released, obviously in the 90s, and it would be the show everyone talked about. And now, obviously, we're so spoilt for choice with obviously Netflix and Amazon and the other streaming services, as well as multiple channels that we have, that it's a lot harder, would you say, for a show to have that same sort of cultural appeal?
I don't know. I think there's still, you can still cut, you can, I think it is harder when you've got, you know, in the sort of, in the world of multiple channels, and you know, you've now got all of these, streaming services sort of coming online, and we were sort of, before we sort of came on air, we sort of, you know, you and I, Elwood, grew up in a country where, you know, you used to just have four TV channels, and I can even vaguely remember when we only had three. So, you know, people, whether they wanted to or not, people watched the same thing. So in that world, it was much easier for, for programs to be, for everyone to watch the same programs, and for those to be hugely popular or hugely loathed, depending on how good they were. I do kind of, in terms of the comeback of the X-Files, you know, when they sort of revive these type of shows that have sort of been off air for a long time, I think you do have to be sort of skeptical as to kind of what the motivation is. I can't say I followed Chris Carter's career terribly closely, but I can't remember his name being attached to many recent projects. So
it hasn't been.
Yeah.
He did a pilot. He did an Amazon pilot I believe it was from the very first Amazon pilot season.
Yeah.
And it was, I guess he had this thing that was going to, he was going to do this, wanted to create this series that was basically a modern day Dante's Inferno. And that never went any, it was, from what I understand, it was picked up, but never actually went anywhere.
Yeah, the after.
The after, yeah.
Because it came out the same time they were doing the Zombieland pilot, which thankfully never went anywhere. But yeah, you're right, like, everyone really raved about the pilot, and then it didn't go anywhere. They never chose to carry on. It's not sure whether Amazon pulled out or Carter pulled out, because he won at that point, maybe he'd got hints that the X-Files could come back. With Chris Carter, he's so laid back. I mean, he sort of finished off X-Files and then spent all his time like rock climbing and surfing until they brought him back to do the second X-Files movie in 2008.
Yeah.
I mean, he sort of played around with other series. I mean, he had the two sort of spin-off series, Millennium and The Lone Gunman. Again, they were meted with very mixed results. There are X-Files fans who just like the X-Files and don't like the spin-offs. I personally like Millennium and Lone Gunman, but I'd never watched Harsh Realm, which was, again, his another attempt to sort of break out. But yeah, he's one of those screenwriters that the fans will, like, fight you to the death if you say anything bad about him, where there's other people who just don't get his appeal.
I'm a diehard X-Files fan. I've been a diehard X-Files fan since probably about the fourth season premiere in the U.S. But I don't... I try not to go and look at anybody in any creative position as being completely infallible. I mean, many of my least favorite, you know, X-Files episodes are ones that he wrote, and... You know, in many ways, I often think for any show, it's a lot of my favorite episodes are the ones not done by the creators or the showrunners. And the showrunners often come up with a lot of the, you know, the weaker ones, you know. And I've kind of had that relationship with a number of shows, like, you know, the Doctor Who revival and so forth. And Fringe was another one that I thought that the episodes actually written by the showrunners were not always the strongest ones. And, yeah. You know, I think there's such, I think, a cult of the showrunner now that really seems to, you know, kind of someone in the top creative position. And I think people, and particularly there are shows, particularly in the cult, you know, era that, you know, that that really kind of inspire a lot of devotion. The X-Files was one of them. And I think it might just be, you know, part and parcel to go along with that, that, you know, the X-Files is great. Chris Carter, this is Chris Carter's vision. Therefore, Chris Carter must be Jesus incarnate. And it, you know, Chris Carter is not the only showrunner I've seen that kind of devotion attached to. Actually, I think Joss Whedon probably has it, probably even a more devoted fan base than, say, Chris Carter does.
Yeah. I think the difference really between Chris Carter and Whedon is the fact that with Whedon's writing, he frequently was writing some of the best episodes of his series, where when we look at Carter's series, I mean, we're looking at the likes of Wong and Morgan, who were really sort of the key writers of the series and wrote the sort of best episodes, and he may like hit one or two sort of great episodes per season. I'm trying to think. The creator of Breaking Bad as well did some great episodes.
Vince Gilligan, yeah. Vince, yeah. It was, you kind of went through these cycles where, you know, Wong and Morgan were there in the early years. They were there for the first season and a half, and DeHandy Verletzt was actually kind of supposed to be like their last episode for the show. And then they went on, they left the X-Files to go and create Space Above and Beyond, which ran one season and flopped. And then they kind of went back to the X-Files to kind of, they went back to the X-Files for season four, because at that point, the Chris Carter was developing what would become Millennium.
Yeah.
You know, and then from, you know, when Morgan and Wong step away, and that's when, that's basically when, like, the writers that basically kind of take over as the head writers of the Chris Carter kind of start take over the show. That's when, you know, Frank Spotnitz starts to become more prominent. That's when Vince Gilligan, you know, starts contributing his first couple episodes. Season three is when you got John Shippen, who is, like, the other head writer for the rest of the series run. And then also at this point, you have Darren Morgan, Glenn's brother, coming in and basically writing these very postmodern episodes, Humbug, Clyde Bruckman, Jose Chung, and War of the Coprophages, that are often seen today as holding up amongst the very best, if not the very best of X-Files episodes. I would, as I was saying earlier on Facebook, if I had to name a favorite episode of the X-Files, it would be Jose Chung. And from that point on, from season four on, it's pretty much, you know, Carter for the most part sticks really only to the mythology episodes, with basically a lot of the direction of the standalones being determined by, you know, Vince Gilligan and Frank Spotnitz and John Shippen.
I know that certainly when we obviously I posted before we came on that onto the Facebook page and asking people what their favorite episodes were, and it's come back a lot. The favorite episodes were the sort of Monster of the Week, the standalone episodes. Apart from my wife, who actually loves the Unopened File, the Anasazi, Blessing Weight, and Paperclip sort of collective, which obviously she cited as being one of the reasons that she got into the X-Files in the first place, and. If anything, I think she's probably going to be the one who's going to be writing me some harsh comments if I screw up anything on this episode. So, touch wood, we won't screw up any of the details, and I apologize again to any X-Files fans for any details that we do get wrong.
I'll try to correct you as much as possible.
Cool.
Although my memory is very hazy after season four. I continue to watch for a couple seasons after the movie, but part of the thing is that at that point I had taken a night job, and keeping up with television was not really very easy at that point. There was basically kind of like a period between kind of like the end of the X-Files golden age, which was probably season five, and then The Rise of Heroes, where I basically watched almost no television.
Well, what's have you obviously been watching recently? Is there any shows that have been honing your interest, or has it just been more movie-related that your sort of watching habits have been?
Well, I have watched... what I've watched most recently is actually been catching up on Homeland, and I'd watched the... I'm a big fan of the original series. The Homeland, if you're not aware of it, is a sort of an adaptation, fairly loose adaptation of an Israeli series called Prisoners of War, which is absolutely fantastic. I would really recommend going and seeking out Prisoners of War. I think it only ran two series. The second series was even better than the first. Absolutely fabulous. Really gripping TV. I watched Homeland. Because of that, I ended up watching Homeland. Quite enjoyed the first series. Second series, I really thought it fell off a cliff. And after that, I sort of left it alone. But for reasons too boring and long to go into, I decided to watch the third series. And actually was really pleasantly... really pleasantly surprised by it. I ended up going through it really, really quickly. Ended up going through the fourth series as well. And I thought that some of the irritating elements that had bugged me in the second series were sort of sorted out a bit in the third series and definitely in the fourth series. And it's not a perfect series by any means. I do have some trouble with the Carrie character. I think that for somebody who's supposed to work in the world of espionage, now I love spy novels, I love spy films. You know, I just don't see how you can work in that world and not be fairly cynical. And there are many, many times in that Homeland where she just doesn't seem to be frankly cynical enough to be sort of believable as somebody who works on a daily basis for the CIA. But recently sort of caught up on series 3 and 4 and thought both of them were really, really good after having previously sort of abandoned the series. So yeah, Homeland is what I've been watching recently.
And it also features Mandy Patinkin, I'm right in saying, is that right?
You have to remind me who that is.
He was in Princess Bride. He's also was in Criminal Minds for the first two seasons, and he was in Dead Like Me. I believe he's got a beard and a strong Jewish accent.
He plays the
Darla Dahl or whatever.
Yeah, he plays Carrie's boss.
Carrie's not the guy with the big beard or the guy with the goatee.
I believe he's got a big beard.
Okay. Right, I don't remember him from The Princess Bride. I'm not going to go back and check that out, but okay.
Wasn't he Inigo Montoya?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, that's a kid's film, and I'm way past.
Oh yeah. That's a kid's film, but you know, just watching 7 years of Exploding Helicopters, that's fine and purely healthy.
It is. You're preaching to the converted.
So, but no, it really means to me, Amanda Patinkin, that he joins series and then leaves them, citing the reason he's leaving it is because it's the violent content. So he joins Dead Like Me, he does two seasons for that, and then doesn't come back, thankfully, for the sort of attempt to revive it, Life After Death, which was awful, so he probably dodged a bullet there, but cites... because of the violent content, I didn't want to return. So he then goes and joins Criminal Minds, and he stays with them for two seasons. Again, leaves and cites violent content as the reason.
I mean, for crying out loud. I mean, there's an entire industry over here in America literally dedicated to churning out film shows that are cloned from whatever Criminal Minds is cloned from. I mean for crying out loud. I mean, is the guy completely devoid of any knowledge of what goes on TV over here?
He doesn't read a script at all when he takes on these parts. And...
well, he can't. I mean, his agent rings him up and says, "Yeah, we're going to. They've got this great role. They want you as the director of the CIA." I mean, who did he think the CIA were? A humanitarian organization? I mean, what? The guy must be an idiot.
Admittedly, there are people in the United States who do think the CIA is a humanitarian organization.
It's frustrating that he keeps leaving series for this reason, but at the same time, I do like seeing it whenever he's there, and hence why I keep singing Mandy at the screen every time he's on Criminal Minds.
Oh, he came and he gave without taking.
He came and he brought us a turkey on our vacation from worky.
Barry Manilow, ladies and gentlemen.
But speaking of mannerisms, Mr. Lackey, you have also been recently compared to sounding very similar to the brain gremlin from Gremlins 2.
I have.
You have. So would you care to give us a quick few bars of New York, New York, while we're on the subject?
I've lived a part of it in old New York.
Very nice.
Like, I don't even know the lyrics to that song. I just know it's about New York.
So, no doubt there's a member of the Lamb cast who's going to be very happy, Mr. Rehack.
Okay. Well, there you go, Nick.
Enjoy.
Always happy to, you know, make a fan please a fan. I honestly think if any of the gremlins in Gremlins 2, I feel more of a kinship to. It's the ones that are in the stockbroker scene that are yelling, buy, sell, buy, sell, buy, sell, which just strikes me as just put two monsters screaming buy and sell at each other in high-pitched, squeaky voices. That, to me, is comedy gold. I could literally watch that on a loop for, like, 5 hours.
Yeah, if you would, I do like Gremlins. Definitely check out the Christmas special of the Lambcast, where they cover both Gremlins 1 and Gremlins 2. In particular, looking at why Gremlins 2 is just so darn random.
Yeah, pretty much. From what I understand, it was just Joe Dante didn't want to do it, and managed to somehow basically said, okay, I'll do it if you give me complete creative control, and weirdly enough, they gave him complete creative control, so... That's why you have a Hulk Hogan cameo in it, and the Looney Tunes, the Brain Gremlin.
Mm. If you watch the VHS version, you get John Wayne shooting the gremlins instead of Hulk Hogan.
Oh, I did that. I don't think I knew because I've only ever seen the theatrical version.
Okay, yeah, they break the tape, and you get the same silhouette sequence, but instead of Hulk Hogan, it cuts to John Wayne having to shoot out with gremlins. So. When we're looking at the credits, it comes up and it says Hulk Hogan. And I looked at my dad, I was like, Hulk Hogan wasn't in this movie. Why the hell is he in the credits?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I could see that, you know, particularly pissing off, like, you know, like wrestling fans like you.
Not really. I think the only people who care for Hulk Hogan are sort of non-wrestling fans. Sort of wrestling fans don't really tend to care for the franchise killer, so.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know that about him.
Yeah, he any franchise he's basically been part of, he has managed to drive into bankruptcy, it seemed, from WCW to TNA.
Wow.
Now WWE has dropped him like a hot potato because he turns out he's a racist as well.
Ah,
lovely.
But yeah, did anyone ever watch Hulk Hogan's Rock and Roll Wrestling?
I probably did when I was a kid. I don't even remember being all that into wrestling when I was a kid.
Okay, so it's just me.
Yeah, it could just be you. I don't know. I'm sure there are other people out there.
Fair enough.
But, you know.
I'm always amused when you have, like, reality shows where they try to teach people to be wrestlers. Like, Hulk Hogan had his celebrity wrestling where he had Screech from Saved by the Bell.
Dustin Diamond!
Yeah, Dustin Diamond.
Dustin Diamond had to be a professional wrestler. Nothing bad can happen.
Oh, no, this is better. The cast of this was brilliant. You had Butterbean, like the 500-pound boxer.
Oh, Christ.
You had Dennis Rodman, a.k.a. Rodzilla. And Donnie Badalucci, or the Ginger Kid from...
Danny Bonaducci.
Bonaducci. Anyway.
The youngest part member of the Partridge Family.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Danny Bonaducci.
And these were like some of the random people that they recruited for this show. If you look on YouTube, you can probably find it on there, but it's probably one of the most random reality shows you can find. But yeah, it's certainly a fun afternoon's viewing there for you. Well, have you watched anything else? Has it just been sort of the Homeland kick you've been on before we obviously went off on that tangent there?
In TV-wise, pretty much the Homeland kick. I went and saw Creed this week, the kind of the seventh film in the Rocky franchise. And yeah, pretty solid entry. It didn't, I can't really get any more excited about it than that. It's very well, you know, it's well made and everything. But it's no Rocky III as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, depends where, I guess, you know, the Rocky franchise has, you know, started as gritty, then went into kind of like complete pantomime, then went back to sort of gritty with Rocky Balboa. And they're sort of still in that sort of realm with this. And I think I'm more I think I'm more panto Rocky in terms of my interest in the franchise.
Yeah. So are you excited to see Rambo, the TV series, coming out?
Apparently it's not happening now.
Oh, no.
It's been canned.
Oh, I really wanted Wilma Vanderrama from That 70s Show to take on the Rocky mantle. Just like this really small Rocky, just like being chased in the woods by police. I just thought that would have been brilliant. But especially if it's as any good as the Dusk Till Dawn TV series, which has been really surprisingly good.
I have not watched any of that.
Yeah, once you get past the idea, it's basically rehashing the first film from what I've seen so far, but they're expanding parts. It's been surprisingly good. It's some good writing there and some interesting young directors who Rodriguez is bringing in to sort of do it. But you can see that he's obviously looking at the story he did with the first Dusk Till Dawn and thinking, okay, where can I expand this? Where do we sort of have to cut things back to obviously tell the story we're telling? So,
well, it's just horribly wrong with the sequels.
I was just going to say, it's a shame you didn't take such care and attention with the DVD sequels.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
It really, really takes a lot of work to make a movie where I don't even like the Robert Patrick character.
Oh, Robert Patrick's back in the series. He plays the preacher.
Oh.
So he takes on the Harvey Keitel role, so there's some of that. Lucky, what have you been watching them?
It's been basically movies for me for the past month and a half because of award seasons I've had to catch up. But right now we're kind of getting on to the beginning of my my diehard television watching season. That has already started 2 weeks ago. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which is about the only sitcom I really, really like, debuted its premiere for season 11 about 2 weeks ago. And then obviously, so in the future, we've got X-Files is starting on Sunday. And then in the future, The Americans will be premiering in March. Better Call Saul will be premiering in, I think, February.
Yeah.
What's that other show? Bates Motel, I think, March. I'm sure the show for which I have received a round amount of mockery for, called The Midwife. I know that it's already started on your side of the Great Divide, and we should be getting it pretty soon, I would think.
You watch Call the Midwife?
I watch Call the Midwife, yes.
It's like the same fucking episode again and again and again.
It's comfort food.
And it's not a good episode either.
It's comfort food. I had a crush on Jessica Raine. She's not on the show anymore, so I can't really justify it anymore. The only thing I can say is I watch it with my mother. It's a family thing that brings people together.
How many times can you watch a woman give birth in the back house with no running water? I mean, just
apparently 8 times a year.
Okay.
Apparently, I do that 8 times a year. I have a strong constitution for that kind of thing. I don't know. I like the show. I can't justify it in any way, shape, or form.
Okay, Lucky, if you've got such an affliction for wanting to watch women give birth, at least watch Bodies. That's the show I would recommend you watch. It's got Keith Allen. Is that right? Yes. Yeah, Keith Allen. I keep getting confused with Keith Harris, which is the guy with the green duck.
Keith Allen as in Lily Allen's father?
Yes, Lily Allen's father as in the guy was also in Trainspotting and Shallow Grave and, you know, the cool indie British movies.
The ones, yeah, I've never seen Trainspotting, oddly enough.
Okay.
I tried to watch Shallow Grave at one point, and for whatever reason, I could not concentrate on it. I think the only film I've ever seen Keith Allen in, I believe he was in 24 Hour Party People.
He possibly was. I can't really say if he was or he wasn't, but...
I mean, now, admittedly, everybody in Britain was in that movie.
Yeah. That's how we tend to run the British film industry, so...
Yeah.
But, no, definitely Bodies. It's an older series. It was shown on BBC Two. Only ran for two seasons. But, yeah, it's about... again, it's about working in a labour ward, and Keith Allen's sort of one of their heads... head of wards there. He's one of the head doctors, but an absolute bastard. Which makes it worthwhile, and he's one of the most generally entertaining characters in the whole show.
Cool.
So it's just been you're just continuing to leech off the BBC off mine and Will's TV payments then.
Basically, yeah. You know, I just have to say to the two of you, and to indeed everybody listening, all of our friends in Britain, thank you for contributing your yearly license fees for your television licenses to keep me accustomed to being entertained in the manner to which I'm accustomed. I did find out today rather interesting news. There will be, other than the TV special, the Christmas special, there will be no new Doctor Who in 2016 because Stephen Moffat's leaving the show after the 2017 series. He will be replaced in 2018 by the writer of Broadchurch.
Okay.
So
they should let me and Will write it. You know,
They should let me write it. They should actually just hire the three of us.
You know, we're just if you let Will write it, we're just there, like fill it with more exploding helicopters so he can start a whole new section of his blog.
Well, it would look, I think there was, you know, like a lot of helicopters exploded on the show in the early 70s during John Pertwee's reign, so you know, I think we could really bring it back to the classic days. You know, I think that would be a good thing. We could get Sean Pertwee to star on it. It would be, I would like that.
Well, is that something you would ever be interested in doing, like a TV section for just exploding helicopters on the small screen, or is it only the big screen explosions that sort of matter to yourself?
I've got my work cut out with movies. I'm not going anywhere near TV for the sake of my sanity.
Okay, just the last couple of things to sort of round up, really, TV-wise. It's been mainly sort of Netflix exclusives that I've been mainly focusing on. I finally watched the whole of Orange is the New Black, ahead of the new series, which is launching soon, along with Kimmy Schmidt, which is also coming back this year. I also checked out Master of None, which, again, had rave reviews, but for myself, it was kind of hit and miss. I don't know if anyone else has watched Master of None yet.
I've heard of it. That's the one with Aziz Ansari from Parks and Recreation.
Yeah, it's his sort of debut series. He's writing it with Alan Yang, and he's like this actor who does like bit parts in like commercials and that, and it's about him and his friends sort of like trying to carve out a little life for themselves in New York. But the problem with Aziz is that he always seems to just give the same performance. Like, he never changes emotion or gets upset or angry. He just seems to pull the same face where he looks like he's been inflated the whole way through. But there's some really great episodes in the series. In particular, if you're just going to watch one, I would watch the episode 9 called Mornings, which could itself just be viewed as a little like small movie on its own. It's just so absolutely perfect. And the episode I would use to introduce anyone who's not seen this series to the actual show itself, but yeah, I'd be interested to see a second series, but it probably didn't hit me as well as it did everyone else. But certainly Netflix, what with their Marvel productions, and as well as series like Master of None and Orange is the New Black, House of Cards are really, again, sort of leading the way. And again, Amazon are as well with their exclusives and perhaps giving the mainstream channels a run for the money and the content that's been put out there. So, do we have a preference as a group over whether we like to binge watch a series or watch it in installments?
There are times when I binge watch. I remember one time I watched the entire second season, Asylum season of American Horror Story. I watched that almost entirely in one day.
Yeah.
I don't do that a whole lot very often. Certainly, partially because I also have to do movies as well, and my poor little brain only has so much capacity for visual entertainment input. So it really doesn't. Binge watching is not something. I think the last time I did it was a few months ago when I did Rick and Morty. I did Rick and Morty. I did the entire first season, I think, in about 3 days.
Yeah, I can understand that. Will, do you like to binge watch, or more of an installment watcher?
I do a bit of both. Each has its own merits. I think, you know, if you're really into something, then it's great to be able to just crack through it as quickly as you want to. Watching things in installments, I think what that does provide you with the, you know, if it's a series which other people that you know are watching it, if it's, you know, if you're watching it as the episodes broadcast sort of, you know, once every week, then you've got that opportunity to kind of like debrief with your friends about what happened in that particular episode, where you think the storyline is going to next. So I think that, yeah, when series are shown broadcast in kind of like weekly installments and people are really into them, that kind of gives you that opportunity to kind of have a shared experience with people in a way in which binge watching doesn't, because, you know, some people are going, you know, everyone's going through the series at a different pace. So each has their merits. So, you know, I kind of, you know, and I watch series both ways myself. So
cool. Right. You know, on that note, I think because we've already spent like the first hour just talking about, you know, what we've been watching and exploding helicopters and the revival of the X-Files. So I think the best place to obviously start really would be to start with by looking at the big influences for the X-Files, which would be the Night Stalker or Kolchak the Night Stalker, depending on where in the world you are. It comes under the two sort of titles. Lackey, I mean, this was obviously your selection. I mean, do you want to give us a bit of a brief on why you chose this one?
Well, it's to kind of go back to the history of the Night Stalker of the show. It started off as an unpublished novel called The Kolchak Tapes by a guy named Jeff Rice, which had come to the attention of a television and film producer by the name of Dan Curtis. What Dan Curtis is mainly known for is creating and producing Dark Shadows, which has gone through its, you know, various fads of fashionability over the years. He's done some other things too. He directed Trilogy of Terror. I don't know if Trilogy of Terror has quite the reputation in Britain as it does over here, but anybody of a certain age in America, just go up to them and say, you know, Tiki Fetish Doll, and they know exactly what you're talking about. But anyway, I had first heard about, and then they did a movie called The Night Stalker, a TV movie called The Night Stalker, and then a sequel movie called The Night Strangler, which were produced by Dan Curtis and adapted by Richard Matheson, the horror writer who wrote the
I Am Legend.
I Am Legend, yeah. I Am Legend and a couple of other things, and he was also a television screenwriter, wrote Duel, Legend of Hell House, stuff like that. And they did fairly well. And, you know, I think it was ABC, I think, was the network it aired on, wanted a series. And neither Dan Curtis nor Richard Matheson were actually involved in the series. It ran for, I think it ran for a full season. I don't think it was canceled mid-season. But it didn't really do very well. And I remember, for much of the like late 80s and early 90s, my horror entertainment bible was a book called Danse Macabre by Stephen King. And Stephen King had a lot of very good things to say about the original Night Stalker TV movie and just completely savaged the television show.
Oh, really?
He had nothing good to say about it. Now, a couple years later, you know, and by the mid-90s, the X-Files came along, and, you know, when I became an ex-fan of the X-Files, I started, like, you know, looking at interviews with Chris Carter, and Chris Carter had cited the show as one of his primary influences, and talking about, you know, how it had scared him so much when it was on television, when he was in his, I guess, late teens, early 20s, and I'm sitting here thinking, no, I thought this was crap. Stephen King says it's crap. It's got to be crap. Stephen King can't be wrong about this. And I have actually, to this day, I've meant over the year, obviously I've actually come to some sort of, you know, consensus that there is some fallibility in Stephen King's opinions. I blame that particular you know, my particular worship of him on the fact that I was a teenager at the time. Yeah. But, you know, I've seen the original TV movie, and it's quite good. I had never gotten around to seeing the show, and it was just something where when we were talking about putting something together, like an X-Files thing for this episode, and I'm thinking, well, I can go in many different directions. I can do another X-Files episode. I can do something that was like a contemporary or like a slight contemporary. I can do like a Twin Peaks type thing, which had its influences on X-Files. I can do something that preceded the X-Files. I could do something that came after the X-Files. And I thought, you know, I should see a Kolchak episode. I've never seen the Kolchak series.
Okay.
And I just basically looked at the roster of episodes, and I thought I picked this particular one because it's like, well, this one's about an alien, and the X-Files is about, you know, the X-Files, what the mythology was about alien invasion, but the episode you had picked was a standalone, a Monster of the Week, which is fine. And in retrospect, at the time X-Files was on, I really liked the mythology episodes. But, you know, from the, you know, the point of view of, you know, 20 years later, I do prefer the Monsters of the Week now. Yeah. But I thought, so let's do this. Let's pick this one at random and see what it does.
Wow, I can't believe that you picked this episode at random, because there are obviously 20 episodes in the Kolchak Night Stalker TV series, and you know, if you're going to pair it with the X-Files, this is the episode to choose, because it probably, as you say, it because of the alien angle to the plot here, it's the one where there are the most parallels to the X-Files series. So it's a good pick from that perspective. Where I would say though, where it's possibly a bad pick is, I'm not particularly keen on this particular episode as and I wouldn't want, if you're new to the Kolchak TV series, I wouldn't want this episode to be your sort of entry point, because as a sort of standalone episode, ignoring the X-Files parallels, it for me it's one of the weaker episodes from the TV run.
I agree with you, Will. This isn't one of the better ones. This is, despite obviously only running for 20 episodes, they somehow managed to cover all the major arcs, so zombies, werewolves, vampires. They even do a play on Jack the Ripper in the first episode, The Ripper, which again is a nice little twist. Obviously this one, the title being They Have Been, They Are, They Will Be, also known as UFO. So it is a UFO one, an alien sort of based one, and you can see, especially if you're an X-Files fan, where they borrowed things, such as there's a scene in the zoo where you see the animals' cages and you see this light off screen that's sort of releasing the animals. And it reminded me of the X-Files episode Fearful Symmetry, where, again, you have UFOs causing animals to be released in the cages and then randomly appearing, including that wonderful opening where we have the elephant walking down the Midwestern highway.
Mm-hmm.
I really love the character of Kolchak, who's basically this sort of gumshoe reporter who has his sideline investigating strange cases, and he's got sort of like, what would you say his hat is? It's not a straw hat, as I call it.
I thought it was a straw hat, actually.
It's kind of like a straw hat, and he dresses kind of oddly, and he basically puts himself in people's faces where he shouldn't be. He's got a very disregard for sort of rules, and he'll do anything if he feels there's a good story to be had. And in this case, he's obviously torn between wanting to find out the mysterious events happening at the zoo, and at the same time, he's trying to get to this fictional World Series game where the Chicago Cubs are playing the Boston Red Sox. And this is a running joke throughout the episode where he's getting bits and pieces of the sports game as it's going on across, but of course the radio signal keeps cutting in and out. But
and I would point out, if I'm correct in my beliefs here, such a game would never actually ever happen like that, because the World Series is between the top teams, the top team in the American League and the top team in the National League. And if I recall correctly, the Cubs are a National League team. I know they are because they're from my hometown. and if I would be said to have a baseball team I owe allegiance to, it would be the Cubs. The Red Sox, I believe, are also a National League team.
Okay.
So
I'm going to take your word for it because I know nothing about baseball apart from...
I think it's a joke. I'm assuming it's a deliberate joke on their part because the Cubs have a notorious reputation as being losers and not having made it to the World Series since just after World War II and not actually having won the World Series in over 100 years. And at the time, the Red Sox also had like a similar reputation for not being losing, and even if they would do well, they would get to the championships and they would choke epically. Since then, they've had some success in, I believe, the double aughts.
Okay.
But that is a cruel joke on the part of the writers.
I mean, what do we think about the alien in this episode? I mean, here we have an invisible alien, which I think is probably one of the biggest cheats you can have in writing, that if you're not going to show an alien in some form, be it like a heat signature, as in the X-Files episode Fallen Angel, or you get to see something. Here we get to see nothing. We don't get a heat signature. We don't get to see like a tentacle or just anything. We see Nathol. As a group, what did we think of the alien? I thought it was a bigger cheat as Super 8 was.
I thought that I agreed with you. It felt a little bit like, you know what, we haven't got the budget here to do anything that would remotely approximate an alien, so we're going to choose the easiest solution and just not show anything at all. So it did feel a bit of a cheat, but probably it was, you know, probably better that than to show something really terrible. So I kind of found it the sort of the least of my problems with the episode. I actually found the pacing of this episode more problematic. It felt really rushed because there's a whole manner of different sort of threads in this particular episode. So as we've already sort of alluded to, you've got this part of the storyline is about these zoo animals that are being mysteriously released or killed. You've got this the theft of these lead ingots, radio equipment is going missing, so all of these things are sort of being thrown into the mix, and the story just doesn't really sort of develop. It just sort of hurtles along in a way, it just skims over everything. So actually, in terms of the problems I had with the story, I you know, seeing the alien really sort of paled into insignificance compared to the way that the storyline just felt really, really rushed, and as a result a bit undercooked for me.
Yeah,
I would agree with Will in that ultimately, it's something that I think not showing the alien, I think that for the invisible alien, I think that actually basically worked for me, because I think in a situation like this, to have a Doctor Who rubber suited alien, I think would have really, I don't know if I would say killed the episode, because I think all three of us are in pretty much agreement here that this is an episode that has problems that go above and beyond rubber suits.
Yeah.
But I do have to agree with Will on the pacing. This is an episode that tries to do too much. And in addition, you know, there are plots that Will didn't and Elwood have not even mentioned here. In addition to the baseball game, in addition to the dead animals, in addition to the missing radio equipment, the missing electronic equipment, the vanishing lead ingots, we've also got this thing where Kolchak drives around the north side of the city, investigating this phenomenon where like black tar like goop gets dumped on people's lawns in a memorable, I thought fairly memorable scene, but somewhat half baked scene involving Dick Van Patten from It Is Enough. And not to mention, on top of all that, the conspiracy angle, which involves a couple of government agents who show up about halfway through the episode and only vaguely appear on screen. And then to have the first half of the episode, or first really two-thirds of the episode, be so frenetic and just everything happening at once. And it's Kolchak is bouncing around the city like a pinball off bumpers. And then you have this incredibly slow final act that just, or even really final act, two final acts really, that take place inside the planetarium. And it just drags out too long.
Yeah.
But the element with the kind of mysterious government officials who are clearly leading a sort of cover up of the events here. I think, you know, if you're interested in the X-Files, you'll, you know, that's obviously some that's obviously a theme and idea which is central to you know, kind of like several of the sort of major plot strands which you know, underpin the entire sort of X-Files series. So, you know, certainly whilst that was an element that was undercooked, it is, you know, for X-Files fans, I think it would be you know, of interest to sort of see you know, the things that were inspiring, you know, Chris Carter with this series that he would then create sort of many years later.
Yeah. The scene where the ingots are being stolen from the bank vault, and we see the bank vault explode from the outside. Now, I don't know if anyone else noticed this, but if you look at the policemen that are gathered outside, a lot of them are being thrown for the air before anything's actually happened.
Oh, you noticed that too?
I wasn't sure if it's how they shot it, whether they shot like additional footage that was supposed to be placed after the vault had exploded, but they got the sequencing wrong. But you see these police officers randomly flying through the air despite nothing actually happening.
Yeah, editing error.
But yeah, this is generally the only thing the alien can do is to make people fly through the air. And there's a whole section where apparently the flash from Kolchak's camera, or is it the recharging battery noise?
It's the battery recharger. When his flash, he initially thinks it's the flash. He thinks that the alien is afraid of light, and then he takes a photo, and then he realizes no, it just really hates the annoying kind of whiny buzz that the battery recharger makes. Yeah.
And I mean, even after we find this information, nothing's done with this information. We basically, the alien gets in his spaceship and sods off home. And that's the episode. There's no big showdown that you think it's going to build up to. I agree with you both. There's some horrible pacing issues with it. And I think I would have hated it more if the character Kolchak wasn't so enjoyable to be around. Certainly this hour episode really felt like it went on a lot longer than it does.
Yeah.
But the payoff at the end is just so naff. We get the spaceship. The door opens, because obviously the alien is still invisible at this point. Door closes, and the episode pretty much ends. We get a bit of an epilogue with Kolchak, and that's it.
I kind of liked the ending. I kind of liked that there wasn't like an ultimate big showdown between Kolchak and the alien. What I was kind of expecting, I wasn't expecting a showdown by any stretch. I was actually kind of immediately kind of assuming it would have an X-Files type ending where, you know, he sees something that he can write about, but nobody's ever going to believe him, and he has no absolute proof of what happened. You know, that's how I would assume that it was going to go down, and that's pretty much what happened. I thought the ending was fine.
Okay. Will, what's your sort of feelings with the character Kolchak? I mean, what is it you like or do you dislike about this character?
Well, I love the Kolchak character, and you know, I agree with Lackey. He, even in the weaker episodes of this TV series, or it may have even been in yourself, you know, the Kolchak character carries the viewer through, because he's, I was trying to think how best to sort of sum him up, because he's not world weary at all. He's almost like world unweary. He's clearly somebody who's been around, who's seen a lot of things, but actually he is still really enthusiastic about trying to root out these stories and kind of get to the truth of things. And, you know, he's kind of, you know, he's kind of hard bitten, but he's good hearted at the same time. So he's got these kind of elements to his character which are maybe slightly in opposition, but somehow, you know, Darren McGavin is a wonderful actor, and somehow he makes them into a whole and be able to work together in this particular sort of series. And he, you know, Darren McGavin has a wonderful voice, which he uses also really wonderfully well here. And in a lot of the episodes, he is given a voiceover, and you know, the script often gives him these sort of dry, droll lines that to deliver, and that's an element of the program that that really works well. So I think it's I think that's probably what the character of Kolchak is definitely one of the strongest elements here, and it's his character combined with Darren McGavin's delivery that really draws me in.
Yeah. Agree. The narration is in these episodes is so great, especially because it's got an almost noir sort of style to it.
That's what I was going to say. That he's almost a character. He's not as hard bitten and cynical necessarily as a noir character, but he's got that hard boiled edge to him. He's somebody, and he's basically somebody who you know in his own sort of weird way, he is an idealist. He's someone who believes very much in the truth and bringing the truth to light. And you can always push him down, but he'll always get back up again. You know, he's got that. And again, with this sort of noirish, and that's where I figure the hat came from, because this was kind of a point where men had basically stopped wearing hats in public. You know, the little fashion note there, and by him having a hat. I always felt kind of gave you, it was a subtle way, I guess, of maybe not deliberate, but cluing me in that I'm not necessarily seeing a character that's necessarily of the early to mid 70s, that he's maybe that the Pearl Jam was maybe a bit of a throwback to maybe something like the 50s and 40s and 50s. You know, and definitely Darren McGavin's performance is almost a sort of classic Private Eye performance. You know, I could see him taking that kind of performance and going back and doing like a Mike Hammer or a Sam Spade type character with that kind of performance.
I think Darren McGavin actually did play Mike Hammer at one point. So I you know, whether he did or he didn't, let's not get bogged down in that. But I completely agree with you. Yeah, he is almost like a Private Eye character. And I think that's the, you know, he plays that journalist role very much as a classic sort of noirish PI.
Okay. And Will, obviously as a established fan of the series, what would you say is the episode to really start with?
I would actually say to start with the TV movies. They benefit from some really good production values. You've obviously got the writing of Richard Matheson, you know, one of the kind of greats of sci-fi and horror involved in that. The episodes are obviously, as they're TV movies, they run a little bit longer. So I think they clock in generally at about 75, 80 minutes. And that allows the plots to be developed at a bit more of a organic pace. So we were criticizing this plot for the harem scarum way that it has to kind of try and weave together all of these threads. And in the TV movies, they can develop the story a little bit better. The casts in those TV movies are really good as well. So you've got people like, you know, if you're a big fan of cinema from the 40s and 50s, there's a lot of actors you'll recognize. So there's people like Ralph Meeker, Charles McGraw, Elisha Cook Jr., John Carradine. So you've got all of, you know, so backing up, you know, Darren McGavin's like brilliant performance, the writing of Richard Matheson, you've then got some really, really solid like character actors who, you know what the hell they're doing. So I would say go back, start with the Night Stalker TV movie, watch the Night Strangler TV movie. And if you like what you see there, then head on into the TV series.
Any sort of final thoughts on this one before we wrap this one up?
I would say that this maybe might not have been the best place to start from, but I'm a noob to the show, but I'm not a noob to the character. I have seen the original TV movie. I never did see the Night Strangler, but definitely I would say here, the episode had some problems, but it didn't, certainly would not keep me from investigating the rest of the series there. You know, I liked, as much as I didn't like the pacing problems, you know, and other things. I liked a lot of the side stuff. I liked a lot of his relationships. I really liked his banter with the doctor at the zoo. I really liked his banter with his colleague at the I don't remember her name, but the one that basically, when she turns over his audio tape to the authorities, she goes and she hides in a dark room or something. I thought that was a great scene.
You know, that was the toilet, I think.
Yeah, something like the toilet or something like that. But I thought, and I thought the interaction between the characters was top notch. I loved that.
And that's a theme, that's a thread that does run throughout the episode. So in this episode, they have the gimmick of the bull game, which just kind of works away in the background. And there are elements like that in a lot of the other episodes. They're not overplayed. They're just there in the background, but it adds to the fun of the series. Just a couple of points for me before we sort of like wrap up. There's some in the TV series, there's some very if you look at the writing credits on some of the episodes, there's some interesting names there. So quite a few of the episodes in the TV series were written by David Chase, who then went on to write The Sopranos many years later. You've got a very well-known name from British Hammer Horror there. Jimmy Sangster wrote one of the episodes. Yeah.
Cool.
I can't remember which one, but he contributed an episode, and I think Robert Zemeckis has kind of contributed a story idea to one episode.
Robert Zemeckis, if I recall correctly, Robert Zemeckis wrote the Headless Motorcyclist one.
And Jimmy Sangster did Horror in the Heights, which is episode 11, which a Hindu Rakshta terrorizes a Jewish neighborhood.
Cool. Oh, cool. I like Hammer.
So I know someone who's getting a co-check set.
Oh, God, yeah.
Well, Nando, we're just going to take a quick break. When we return, though, we're going to be looking at our second program of the evening as we look at the X-Files episode Home.
You are about to witness history in the making.
Hi there, this is Todd from Forgotten Films, and if you spend all your time watching new releases, then you need to broaden your movie horizons. And a great way to do that is by joining me for the Forgotten Filmcast. We don't talk about the new releases, we don't even talk about the classics. We talk about the movies that time forgot. On each episode, I'm joined by another film blogger to discuss a film that may or may not be worth rediscovering. So look for the Forgotten Filmcast on iTunes, Podomatic, and wherever you find great podcasts.
We're back. Still joining me, obviously, in the studio this evening is my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Yo!
And still down here in the basement, we've got our very special guest co-host this evening, Mr. Will Slater of Exploding Helicopters.
Can someone please let me out?
Before we go on, I just also want to give a quick shout-out to Kristen and Todd over at the Walt Simi podcast. If you were over here in the UK, you probably have been catching up with the Toy Story shorts they've been showing, but they've actually been covering all three films over on the Walt Simi podcast, which they released just before Christmas. And it's well worth checking out for all the usual insider knowledge of the Walt Disney franchise and really the sort of mainstay of the Pixar catalog. But definitely, if you're a Toy Story fan, check out those three episodes for some greater information and just general conversation about the series. Obviously, in the first half of the show, we were talking about Kolchak, the Night Stalker. We're now obviously going on to move on to the subject of this show, really, the X-Files. We're going to be looking at the episode Home, which is probably one of the more controversial episodes of the series. When it was released, it got the note back from one of the showrunners that said, don't ever, ever do that again. This is a show which features a baby being buried alive, as well as three mutant inbred brothers going caveman on the local town sheriff and his wife in probably one of the more memorable scenes of the whole series. The episode itself follows Mulder and Scully going to the small backward town of Home, where an infant baby has been discovered buried by some children playing a pickup game of baseball.
That's by the way, that's the unofficial theme of this episode of the podcast, is episodes of television which start with baseball games.
It seems so. We didn't intentionally plan this, but it seems to have turned out that way. Obviously, they, as part of the investigation, they discover a link to the Peacock family, who have been through inbreeding, should we say, have suddenly hit a sort of genetic roadblock and have started burying their offspring alive in the mud for not meeting up to what it seems to be their genetic standard.
A very low genetic standard at that.
Yes. This, as I said, is one of the more shocking episodes. This, interesting as well, is the episode which got Cher into the X-Files as a fan. She cited the scene in which we're introduced to Mrs. Peacock, which we'll obviously discuss a bit later, as being one of the scenes which she took away from the episode and, for some reason or another, decided to become a fan of this show. So good for Cher.
That is a fantastic fact. That's the best fact I've heard for quite some time.
Yeah, she was also set to appear in the episode, the postmodern Prometheus, where the Frankenstein creature is actually a big fan of Cher. And unfortunately, she decided against appearing in the episode, so they got a lookalike to play the Cher role in it. And it was only after she saw the episode that she cited it as a big regret not actually being in the episode, because how respectfully they treated her, well, herself, really, that she kind of wished that she had done it. So, kind of a loss for Cher on that one. But this is really kind of a standout episode. It is absolutely grotesque. It's also worth noting that one of the brothers, Gillian Anderson, would actually go on to marry, which says all sorts about her taste in men.
Adrian Hughes, if I remember correctly, was her first husband.
Yes. But opening thoughts on this one, what do we obviously think of the episode Home?
Well, it is quite some time since I watched an episode of The X-Files. Watched them all when they were on TV, liked the series, and then, you know, haven't sufficiently liked it to ever sort of go back and rewatch it. I have to say, I was pretty shocked and stunned when I watched this episode, because I was thinking, I don't remember the X-Files being quite this dark. Were all the episodes quite as bleak as this one? So your introduction was very useful to put this episode into context. So it clearly is at one end, one particular end of the spectrum. So yeah, you picked a hell of an episode to for us to rewatch here.
Yeah, I mean, this is written by mainstays Glenn and Morgan. This is season 4 now. This is the second episode. And it's one of the Monster of the Week episodes. And for myself, whenever I return to the X-Files, I always look at a Monster of the Week episode rather than something from The Large Conspiracy. I know that those X-Files fans who didn't feel that the conspiracy storyline was fantastic, for myself, it got a little overcomplicated towards the end, and I felt it had an endpoint partway through the series, but for some reason they carried it on. But yeah, Home is one of those episodes that stuck with me, and I was, for when we were picking episodes, going to go with the episode of Humbug, which featured the town of circus sideshow freaks and performers, but decided for some reason or another that Home would be the episode we'd go with. But Lucky, I mean, what's your sort of thoughts on this one?
Yeah, this is about, I believe this is probably actually the single darkest episode of The X-Files. And this is Morgan and Wong's first episode. As I mentioned earlier, with this episode, they returned after a year and a half long hiatus from the show, during which they went and created and ran and saw canceled from under them, Space Above and Beyond. And they deliberately wanted to make a really, really, really strong statement with their first episode back. And this is one that really, it shocked a lot of people actually making during the making of the episode. The actor who played the sheriff had never actually seen the X-Files. He knew Morgan and Wong from, he had been on Space Above and Beyond and was doing this episode for them as a favor. And basically his reaction to when he actually saw the script and what happened over it and what happened to his character was, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into? The director of the episode, the late Kim Manners, also felt that it was he was surprised that it ever made it past the standards and practices department, the censorship department at the network. It is a thoroughly grotesque episode. In both its thematics, in both, like, in terms of, you know, disgusting things shown to the audience, you know, the, you know, gruesome deformities and blood pooling out of the ground, but also just in its subject matter, you know, it tackles a lot of dark subject matter, you know, in its you know, and it's not just the deformed inbred brothers. I mean, they're having sex with their mother. You know, at the end, Scully theorizes that the two younger brothers are of the three Peacock brothers are actually the sons of the eldest. I remembered at the time that it was something that had really shocked me at the time. This was the second, I believe, episode of The X-Files I watched first run. I had gotten into the show over the summer before season four. A friend of mine, this was when they had started to release kind of like The X-Files' greatest hits on home video, where they would release like waves of three tapes a piece. They would do three tapes a piece with two episodes per tape, and they do them like two waves a year. So you would basically have like the 12 greatest hits of a given season, which for the longest time, actually, because I had never actually had the experience of watching the show, sitting down and watching the show episode to episode and episode from the beginning, really actually kind of colored. I didn't realize until I got the DVDs and started to watch them on DVD exactly how much the cherry picked episodes had actually contributed to what I thought, how I felt about the characters. But yeah, this was a dilly to come in as my first run monster of the week, because the season premiere, obviously Aaron Volk, that was the second half of a mythology cliffhanger. And I think this, for the most part, I think this is one where they you can tell almost the sort of reluctance that almost kind of like they know they're going far. They know they're really kind of going into uncharted territory as far as the network television shows go, But, you know, they're almost like they're not pulling punches, but it's almost sort of like a, I don't know. There's a very mournful, sad tone to the episode, you know, how all of the characters from the town of home really kind of feel that we're trying to preserve something here that is to us special.
Yeah.
And we know that the outside world at some point is going to come in and swarm us, and we're trying to protect. And in many ways, you know, that's kind of paralleled between, you know, Sheriff Taylor and Deputy Barney Pastor. And it's something that they put as a parallel between them and between the freaks on the Peacock property. You know, they're basically people that are scared of change, that are scared of the encroaching modernization. This is a small little town where you don't lock the doors at night because you trust everybody, which, you know, the sheriff learns to his doom.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, as well, they highlight the fact that this is a town which only has two police. There's only, you've got the sheriff, Andy Taylor here, played by Tucker Smallwood, and you've got his deputy, and that's it. So essentially, with Mulder and Scully, we have four law enforcement personnel in the whole town, which certainly gives another interesting element when we have the sort of final showdown where they go to sort of assume that they're rescuing a woman that's been held captive by the Peacock family, which obviously turns out to be the boy's mother, who we also discover is a quadruple amputee that is being on a board hidden under a bed. That, as we've mentioned already, the boys are actually breeding with. And this, it seems, has been going on in the family since the American Civil War. And it gives this great element to the episode when we open up and we've got this birth sequence and the brothers are there assisting the mother who's giving birth, but they got, as I said, there's no electricity or running water or heat. It's all, the only light you get is through these flashes of lightning, and you get to see these blunt implements. We see like scissors being used, and it's really quite grotesque to watch. And the fact that it ends with this baby being deemed that it's not genetically viable for the family, so they choose to bury it alive. And while you can obviously see that one of the brothers is very upset, the other is just basically getting on with it. It's got this very detached feeling to it. And it did obviously pose the question, what is the genetic benchmark for this family that they can deem a child to be, you know, worthy of carrying the peacock lineage?
Yeah.
Because obviously the child that is born, we're obviously told through Scully's autopsy, which is, again, carried out in the toilet, because there's no... I'm guessing there's no proper facility.
And the corpse of the baby is kept in the fridge where you can see, like, the policemen have got, like, their lunch and stuff.
Nice.
I mean, it is just... This episode, even you've got really grotesque things even in the broad plot lines, but then throughout the episode there are these smaller details. You know, the autopsy being in this very cramped toilet, the baby being kept in the fridge. There are these smaller details which just keep piling on the grotesqueness in this episode. It really, they clearly went absolutely all out here.
Yeah, and I mean, it's unsurprising that this was the first episode to receive a viewer discretion warning.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder why.
I figure it out.
I mean, we've got a child born here, which Scully advises us that has been born with every birth defect known. And this is somehow the one more managed to even top this. And for the most part, it's not actually what you see, but more what's suggested to you in the episode, such as we have the murder of the sheriff and his wife, with the brothers basically clubbing them to death. But again, it's a lot of it's more implied than what you're actually seeing. And
but within this episode, I felt that there were some sort of slight contradictions with the kind of genetic elements of the plot. So we have the birth of this child, which is deemed genetically too weak, you know, and I kind of got the impression that basically it almost couldn't walk, you know, it was that deformed, it just didn't have any sort of, you know, really sort of functioning limbs. Yet in this episode we see these the brothers be struck by various weapons. They're also shot multiple times.
Yeah.
But they don't seem to be injured or feel that pain. So they're almost genetically, in that sense, genetically superhuman. So this episode does seem to have some inconsistency there, and perhaps they're just trying to sort of have their cake and eat it, you know, by having them have these properties which allow them to be, you know, sort of superhuman and that much more threatening as characters in a way. But, you know, in the context of the episode, it doesn't quite make sense.
It's funny you should mention that, Will, because this is something I only picked up on this episode, and again, it was something my wife pointed out, being the super X-Files fan that she is. And there's a line where the Mrs. Peacock mentions about being involved in the car crash and her arm being torn off and lying across her dead husband's lap, and that she says she doesn't feel no pain, and it's a family trait, and that she has to watch the young'uns because they don't realise they hurt themselves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that, again, I like yourself, I just thought, wow, these guys are really tough. When I previous time to watch the episode, because obviously they're shot multiple times, they're beaten up with like baseball bats and clubs, and the only it takes to stop them, obviously Mulder has to shoot one in the head and the other is killed by a stake booby trap basically being driven through him, and these are seemingly the only ways to kill these boys. But it's through that line that I actually realized, oh wow, it's because the genetic inbreeding, it's now gotten them to the point where they don't feel pain. They're born without any sort of concept of what pain is. And that's why it does actually give us a contradiction here, because at the start we do obviously have Mrs. Peacock and she's screaming in pain while she's giving birth. Now, obviously, if she can't feel pain, she would be giving birth quietly, which obviously is going to lose some dramatic effect. So it kind of, for the most part, works, but I suppose if you're nitpicking, then you do obviously have scenes like at the start, but...
Yeah, I think I think we can probably forgive those forgive those discretions on the bounds of dramatic license.
Yeah. But, yeah, is there anything in particular you liked about this one, or disliked, or...?
I really kind of like the atmosphere of the whole thing. It's got this, like I said, this very mournful kind of atmosphere, which I think really is probably the best you know, successive. I think my favorite thing about it is, you know, just how everybody, you know, I already mentioned. I think it's got some good supporting performances. Great Tucker Smallwood as Sheriff Andy Taylor. I really actually kind of liked, as hokey as it is, and this being a Morgan and Wong episode, it's going to have its classic film and television references. But the, you know, naming the sheriff after, and the deputy after characters from the Andy Griffith Show and the Mayberry references, Scully's quote from Babe was hilarious. You know, I think it's a, I don't know if I'd put it in my top rank of X-Files episodes, but I think it's a very strong episode with a lot to recommend it. I think it's good performances, good direction. I really think that this is, I think Kim Manners was always one of the best directors for the show when it came like to getting like an atmosphere down. And this really does have in its composition and its editing, the scene, particularly the opening scene, the birth scene and the subsequent burial, and then later on the murder of the sheriff and his wife, I think really are very good examples. They're excellent examples of how you can get away with certain things with very intense subject matter, very intense, without necessarily showing everything and going to the gore and all that. And it was very shocking to watch at the time. It was, you know, you very much had a kind of a sense watching at the time of, can they do this on network television? You know?
Yeah. And the scene which shocked me the most in this is the scene where they're going over to the sheriff's house. And they're driving in the Cadillac, and we've got the cover version of Johnny Mathis's Wonderful, Wonderful playing. And it's one of those scenes where you've got a nice, happy, jolly song being twisted in all our minds to something a lot more darker. The same as Wouldn't It Be Nice by the Beach Boys being twisted in the German film Das Experiment.
And that's something that a lot of that time, a lot of the things, Morgan and Wong in general would do that quite a bit. They did that in Beyond the Sea as well. It kind of, you know, twisted that particular, I think the Bobby Darin version of that song. And it's something, I mean, they would do it later on. I think, is it Killswitch where they used, Twilight Time? I think it was one of the William Gibson episodes.
I would need to go back and, I wouldn't be able to say, offhand. I know Killswitch is the one which had the Lawnmower Man style ending where she basically unloads herself into the net.
All right, maybe I'm thinking. I know it's one of the William Gibson episodes, but anyway, we can continue.
The inspiration for this one, there's a lot of some really great inspiration points that Wong Morgan obviously drew from this one. The brothers themselves, they're based on the Ward brothers who are featured in the documentary Brothers Keeper. The Wards themselves, they're four barely literate brothers, and they live on this farm that's been passed through their family for generations. And the documentary itself follows the brothers as they deal with the alleged murder of William Ward by his brother, Delbert. And with an estimated IQ of 68, Delbert escaped prosecution by claiming the police had tricked him during the interrogation. The name Peacock comes from the former neighbor of Morgan's parents. And if you go on Glenn Morgan's Twitter feed, you actually see that Mrs. Peacock is his Twitter profile picture. but this is one they were very proud of actually doing. And it's really great the fact that they come back with season four and they really knock it out of the park with this second episode of the season. The actual idea of Mrs. Peacock being on the board, it's taken from Charlie Chaplin's autobiography. And there's a moment in it where he's obviously touring around a British musical theatre and they stay in a tenement home. And the family took Chaplin upstairs to meet their son. And they pulled him out from under a board, and he, like Mrs. Peacock, was a quadruple amputee who is noted, to quote the book, that flopped around while they sang and danced. And it was really, this was the inspiration for Mrs. Peacock, though under the sort of insistence of Wong, they actually changed it so that the boy instead became the character of Mrs. Peacock. And despite the fact she's on a board and can't really go anywhere apart from to go back and forth under the bed, she's quite an evil and haunting character, despite essentially being little threat herself. The power she has over her boys is more sort of scary than anything else, really. The fact that she can just command them to go off and murder people on a whim, just protect the family. All she cares about is just protecting the family, and she sees nothing wrong in what her boys are doing, because, you know, they're serving their mother. They're showing they love their mother.
The line where she talks about, you know, where she says to Scully, "You're not a mother," and there's just a thing that you don't know, you know, that feeling that you get when you know a boy would do anything for his mother. And that really, I think, is one of the most chilling lines of the episode. It really puts a shiver up my spine. That's the way that actress delivers that line.
Yeah. I think the most freaky part is the fact that you find out that all three brothers are breeding with the mother at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah,
the fact that the mother was a sort of multiple amputee brought back to mind a notorious film from the very early 90s, Boxing Helena.
I was wondering.
Ooh, yeah, I didn't think of that.
Yeah, it was David Lynch, Jennifer Lynch's debut film.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
Because originally Madonna was going to star in that one as well.
Wow.
Cher didn't fancy it then.
Apparently she was unavailable for that one. But if you, Cher herself, if you ever want an interesting afternoon, go and check out Cher's Twitter feed, where some guy asked Cher to sit on his face and she responded, "Go sit on your own face, I'm too busy." So, like James Blunt, she will pretty much reply to anything. Whether it's the response she wants or not is another thing entirely.
Yeah.
Cher's had so many facelifts now, she could probably sit on her own one. There's an image for you.
Yeah. Maybe that was something for the season 10.
Yeah.
I was going to say, you know, if I now I know who to go for my English language remake of Eyes Without a Face.
Getting things back on track, I had a couple of sort of general points sort of about the X-Files and Kolchak, which if I'm allowed, I'll throw in here, if that's all right. Which was just really, I just thought that, you know, obviously Chris Carter very open about the fact that Kolchak, Night Stalker, was an influence on the X-Files. And I think with the X-Files, Chris Carter kind of fixes one of the sort of problems there is for the viewer, especially for the viewer of the TV series of Kolchak anyway, in the sense that, you know, Kolchak is a reporter, he's based in one city, and he keeps, every week he kind of gets thrown into these very bizarre stories with, you know, sort of outlandish causes behind them. And, you know, it does sort of stretch, you know, the sort of credulity and plausibility of the setup. And obviously with the X-Files, Mulder and Scully can roam across the whole of the United States. Their business is actually investigating these weird and strange cases that come their way. So there's much more rationale and justification for the fact that they find themselves in these, you know, incredible scenarios, you know, week after week. So I think that, that's to sort of Chris Carter's credit that, you know, as much as what he took from Kolchak, he actually, improved on it by kind of setting it in, rather than in journalism, moving the sort of setup to the police FBI type of situation here. And one thing I don't think that we have mentioned is also that Darren McGavin was actually cast by Chris Carter in several episodes of The X-Files by way of tribute homage, and he crops up in a couple of episodes as Arthur Dales, as the man who sort of set up and instigated the original X-Files. So there's some very overt links in that way between the two series.
the two surviving Peacocks, obviously, at the end, we only have the one brother and Mrs. Peacock who survive. They've sort of a disconcerting plans to continue to try and breed the family. They do actually show up in the comic series, which is sort of continued at the titled Season 10, but I know a lot of X-Files fans haven't exactly greeted it as being the 10th season and sort of just seen it as a way to get their X-Files fixed while we've obviously been waiting on the new series. But I know that they have actually brought back the Peacocks in that series. Unfortunately, I haven't read it, so I can't really say too much about that. But obviously, if you are wanting more Peacock family fun, then you can obviously check out the Season 10.
Do we think they'll come back in the new TV series? Kind of Wrath of Khan style?
Well, the thing is, I think it's Glenn Morgan's episode is entitled Home Again.
Ooh.
So there has actually been some speculation that it will be a sequel to Home.
That would make sense because I'm sure in the Season 10 strip, it is also called Home Again. So if they are bringing them back, which I really hope that they are, that would be a great one, especially if it's Ken Wong and Morgan who are handling the episode. Because I would hate to see someone else try and pick up the Peacock family and obviously try and recreate what Home is.
Yeah, it's how they're doing Season 10 is it's going to be 6 episodes. 3 episodes are being written and directed by Chris Carter, and then Jim Wong is writing and directing one. Glenn Morgan is writing and directing one, and Darren Morgan is writing and directing one. So, like I said, this one is going to... Glenn Morgan is actually the writer and director of Home Again. So, if they will have the guy who created it doing it, if that's indeed what it is.
Yeah.
I read an interesting article today, actually, on the review of the first 3 episodes of the new series of The X-Files. And they sort of said that it gets off to a bit of a weak start, but actually the 3rd episode... sounded very, very interesting in the sense that it essentially sort of deconstructed the X-Files formula and series. I mean, this was a spoiler-free review, so they weren't really sort of going into detail, but it sound they made it sound a very sort of interesting, and they said basically, you know, it kind of would, you know, forces you to sort of go back and revise your view of some of the Monster of the Week episodes that you'd have seen in the past. So I think there could be some very interesting stuff in this new series.
Yes.
Episode 3, which I am led to believe is called Mulder and Scully Meet the Weir Monster.
Yep.
And as an additional thing, stars Rhys Darby, who is a cohort of the Flight of the Conchords guys, and played a werewolf in What We Do in the Shadows. That is written and directed by Darren Morgan, and Darren Morgan is the one best known for episodes like War of the Coprophages and Jose Chung's From Outer Space, both of which are actual, where he basically does go and deconstruct the formula of the mythology episodes in those 2 episodes. And I have really high hopes, and I have really high hopes for that episode, because Jose Chung is probably my favorite episode of the entire series.
Mm, very interesting.
Well, did you have a favorite episode of the original series, or was it just something that was sort of on at the time for you?
I didn't really, as I say, I watched it, I enjoyed it at the time, but it's not a series that I felt compelled to sort of go back and rewatch. So I don't have any sort of particular episodes that sort of stood out in my particular mind, but you know, I was kind of struck by sort of some of the things that sort of you guys have sort of been saying. You know, I did actually enjoy the through line of the conspiracy plot lines through the series, and as good as the kind of standalone sort of episodes were, I enjoyed the continuing story of those particular episodes. Yeah. So I think the series was offering different people different things, and I think that's all to the good of the series.
Obviously, with the new series coming out. We obviously got Vok, we got Mulder, Scully being confirmed. We've seen Skinner already. At the moment, we've seen no sign of Doggett or Monica Rees, though.
Doggett will not be in it. Robert Patrick turned it down. Annabeth Gish is returning, making a return appearance as Monica Reyes.
Okay. And Keely, we've also got the return of the cigarette smoking man, again still played by William B. Davis, who I'm still not sure how he's managed to come back, considering the end of the original end of the series, as he was pretty much, I would have said, pretty much done and dusted.
They did him and dusted him several times over the course of the show. I hear they brought him back in the comics as well. But yeah, I'm interested in how they're going to bring him back.
Yeah. I love William B. Davis especially because he's so good to the fans, but prior to being on the X-Files, he was like playing, you know, the warm grandfatherly role and the kindly uncle. And
yeah.
So he does the X-Files and it's like a complete departure from those sorts of things. And
The only other thing I'd seen him in before the X-Files, he has a brief role in the TV miniseries adaptation of the Stephen King novel It, which was actually filmed up in Vancouver where they did the first few seasons of the X-Files. So watching that is like watching like a bunch of people who like went on to do X-Files are in that. But William B. Davis has like a blink it you'll miss him role as school principal who just yells at two of the characters.
Have we got anything else that we haven't obviously discussed about Home, though?
I don't think I have anything else.
Well, you got anything you want to...
I'm good.
So there you have it, really. We're at the end of another episode of TV Good Sleep Bad. Before we obviously wrap up the show, Will, if people obviously want to find out more about yourself or enjoy some exploding helicopter goodness, where's the best place to come and find you?
Just type exploding helicopter into a search engine. I've got those search terms absolutely locked down. So, yeah, just type exploding helicopter into a search engine and you'll find us. I'm on Twitter as Chopper Fireball. So, yeah, check out the website, check out the Twitter feed, and you can keep up to date in all things exploding helicopter related.
Cool. And Lucky, over at the Nightmare Gallery and Cinema Access, what's happening over there?
I'm getting out of the award season where I had to look at some of the more well-regarded but still genre-oriented films of the year, and now I'm going back to my first love, which is crappy horror movies. So I've done some crappy horror movies lately, like The Forest, which absolutely sucked, and Mojave, which absolutely sucked. The only good thing about it was Oscar Isaac. And basically, it's going to be a little bit of catching up from some stuff from 2015 that I missed. I do intend to make a full accounting of The Assassin. I would have felt like a jerk for writing up after the first couple times I watched it, because it is really Chinese, and I think a lot of it just went over my tiny little American brain. But yes, you can always find what I am up to at thenightmaregallery.com. And my monthly column for Cinema Access over at cinemaaccess.com, where I contribute with a number of other cracking film writers.
Cool. As for myself, we've just started season 3 of Buffy the Vampire Slayer over at Channel Superhero, which, as always, you can find at channelsuperhero.com, and where also you can find the archive for this show. So if you missed any previous episodes, you can catch it there. Also, we're available, as always, on Podomatic and iTunes. Whereas over as from the depths of DVD hell, it's really just delving back into the depths of DVD hell, really. We've got a review of It Came From Beneath the Sea, featuring one of the more unusual love triangles to be featured in a B-movie ever, where it seems that both male leads are trying to do the same girl at the same time. As well as Howard Hewson's Amazing Six-Legged Octopus. We also have got my reports on Tarantino's latest Western, The Hateful Eight, also coming up as well, which I know is going to be lost in a sea of hundreds of other reviews of that film, but being a Tarantino film, I felt that I needed to get something down. So that's all coming up. But as always, you can find Find us on Facebook if you want to follow the show. You can find us on Facebook. Just look up TV Good Sleep Bad. We are also on Twitter at TV Good Sleep Bad. So if there's any shows you would like to see covered on future episodes, then please do let us know. Or any thoughts on the show, please also let us know there as well. Will, thank you very much for coming on the show this week.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Hopefully we can get you back on for some more cool TV goodness.
Always happy to oblige.
Cool. Lackey, do you know what you're choosing for the next episode?
I think I'm gonna do what I've been threatening to do for about 6 months now, and I think I'm gonna go with some classic Doctor Who goodness.
Okay. Yeah, any particular episode?
The one I'm hovering towards right now is City of Death with Tom Baker, written by Douglas Adams.
Very nice. And for myself, I think just because, you know, we are obviously represented by Channel Supero, and it'd be nice for us to cover something Supero related. So we're going to be looking at the first episode of Japanese Spider-Man.
Ooh!
So that's all coming up next month. But until next time, this is Edward Jones signing off another edition of the TV Good Sleep Bad. Remind you, as always, to keep it strange. And thank you again to my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Thank you, and thank you, Will, for joining us.